Welcome to the Highly Objective Podcast, where we talk to cannabis industry executives and investors and go into the weeds on recent news.
Hello, everyone out there on the airwaves. My name is Mike Siegel. I'm a managing partner here at Flower Hire and Flower Hire Senior Advisors. I've been in cannabis, the industry, for almost 6 years. I actually got involved with cannabis when I was an undergrad at Columbia. I learned in two classes, drug use, abuse, and drugs and behavior from a gentleman named Dr. Professor Carl Hart in New York. During that time, I actually met Ethan Nadelman, who at the time had just founded the Drug Policy Alliance. And so the DPA is a precursor to a lot of my industry knowledge. And the people I had met when I was, you know, bumbling around New York and 18 years old, they are people who are actively involved in the industry today. So I had some context. But prior to cannabis, startups, CPG, my own company, actually, biotech nutraceuticals. And yes, last 6 years, Jason and I have been collaborating and creating alongside David. And I will give a shout out to the rest of the team. One of the more, if not the best recruitment team in cannabis.
Hands down, Mike. Hi, everybody. Jason DeSense here. I'm also a managing partner at Flower Hire and Flower Hire Senior Advisors. I have the privilege to work with Mike, kind of like my work wife, every day, multiple times a day. But I'm also, I spent many years now in cannabis, and I actually had the privilege of working for two cannabis companies here in Michigan, where I'm at, out of Detroit. And one of which was started off in a condo and worked its way all the way to a publicly traded company. I'm pretty proud of being part of that group, as well as other groups to expand the industry and here in Michigan. But as far as my background before that, I'm a recovering chief people officer, as I like to say, outside of cannabis. I was in manufacturing, healthcare, and financial services. So I kind of have a little breadth of diversity, if you will, as far as different industries. And I've been able to apply a lot of my skill sets from those into cannabis, as Mike and I probably will talk about, to make sure, you know, as it's more of a professional setting.
Yeah, so help me understand the scale of Flower Hire today. So been around for a little over 5.5 years. You know, give us some sense of scale and the type of clients you work with and the type of searches.
Sure. So as of today, we're 25 members strong and we're dispersed. It's kind of hub and spoke. So we originally were founded in Southern California in Los Angeles. And now we have folks in, let's see, Michigan, Florida, Pennsylvania. Well, a litany of different states. And yeah, the size and the scope of the companies that we work with are every. I mean, if you can imagine it, we've probably worked with them. We've actually worked in about 25 separate states. We've made over 1,000 placements over the last several years. And MSO, multi-state operator, single state operator, brand, ancillary company. We've actually been lucky enough and fortunate enough to go wherever the markets take us. And the best thing about it, and Dave, we had mentioned this just before we jumped on the call, we actually get to go into early stage markets and actually start looking at that first kind of inception stage company. So oftentimes we're actually working with companies that are being derived for the first time before a market even goes live. So we're actually working with groups, I guess you could call them stealth, but you'll know them momentarily.
Yeah, and on that point, give me an indication right now of like sentiment across some of these states. And I know you guys have been at conferences recently. What's kind of the take on the market as we sit here May 2023?
Oh, I know here in Michigan, it's still the fear of too much saturation. I think some states are, you know, depending upon the, you know, the regulatory authority in each state. You know, I know in the Midwest, there's a lot of saturation. So I think there's concern over the price of per pound and the yield of and all the different growers that are out there. And then there's the other states, right, that are, you know, you don't have enough grows to where you're worried about inventory within the stores. So I think the sentiment, at least in the Midwest that I'm very familiar with, is a concern over the price. And, you know, will it rebound or will you start to see consolidation, which I believe a lot will typically predict it's going to happen here shortly, at least in those more established markets.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of piggyback off of that, it's a big juxtaposition when we talk to any sort of operator. I mean, it's one part trying to figure out a better way in a market that is really suffering like from the macroeconomic boil and also the micro inside cannabis. So in California, as an example, you know, proliferation of enough retail stores, you know, supply has been pretty consistent for a while now. So we have not stasis or equilibrium, but we have a little bit more predictability, but we still don't have enough stores inherently. I think it's about 3 stores per 100,000 people. And then, you know, our work is great because then you have to have this big change in terms of mindset and locale, talking to operators in New Jersey where proliferation of retail stores is very minuscule. I mean, you're talking about 24, give or take, retail stores, and there's only 10 acres of canopy to service that entire state. So, you know, retail operators in that market are beyond enthusiastic because, you know, the run rate is so, you know, demonstrably higher, far above the average. And then again, going back to other markets like in the Pacific Northwest or even places like Colorado, where you have margins and compression that are now kind of akin to CPG, there's almost like a status quo. And then in early stage markets like Michigan, or not early stage, but more maturing markets like Michigan, you have that, you know, that 3 year in price compression derived problem where you're having so much supply in a saturation in specific locales. But at the same time, you still have room for growth in certain areas. So, you know, the sentiment is one part buoyant. People are excited, they're enthusiastic, they're preparing for the first time or the next kind of iteration. In other instances, with longer tail companies in markets that are slowly coming to grips with their own capability or being honest about their lack of oversight or capability, they're trying to figure out a way where they can, you know, have a culture that can be under so much duress and distress, have a culture that can thrive and support its people, all the while trying to understand the mechanics of, you know, a marketplace that are constantly sometimes under change, or they're not moving fast enough to precipitously kind of keep growth forward.
So you guys typically get brought in before a market even opens up. So like I'd imagine a Missouri, you were working well ahead of adult use legalization. So with that, what markets right now have a ton of momentum and demand for flower hire services?
Sure. Maryland, you know, as of a few days ago, July 1st is the absolute start date of that program, the adult use marketplace. So we've had a lot of preemptive conversations, and not just with operators for the first time in the market, but also preceding MSOs or single state operators that are venturing into that marketplace, usually that are nearby. Missouri is, I mean, it's an outlier because it's what's surrounded by 8 states, and there was so much infrastructure already in place, and they made it very easy to migrate from medical to adult use. Seemingly, if you were in good standing after 60 days, you could just start participating in the adult use marketplace. That's why you've seen so much growth. That and also the logistics hubs. You know, Missouri is especially pronounced because a lot of people pass through there. And, you know, long haul truckers, an example, will buy loads of cannabis, have a massive basket size, and they'll head to Topeka, Kansas, which is not too far, or Wichita. So the momentum in Missouri is massive. It's huge. New Jersey also is not early stage, but it's still not even close to being developed in the truest sense. Also in places like Florida, where you had that latest and greatest MMTC licensing happening, you're gonna have a doubling of the number of licenses. That's not early stage, but I would say that for the first time that market's actually trying to evolve. And we also have kind of a lot of conversations with certain participants in certain marketplaces where they feel strong that adult use isn't far either, like Arkansas. Arkansas got absolutely smoked during the latest election run. However, I would say that they're gearing themselves for the next run. So we're already speaking to a number of operators that want to right-size themselves in anticipation of that.
And from a capital standpoint, you know, it's tight today in today's environment. Where are some of these clients kind of finding sources of capital?
Sure. Years ago when we first met, actually, it was venture capital. And then now it's kind of morphed into venture debt. And then also kind of this kind of amalgam of financial durability through real estate. For a lot of early stage operators, again, single state operators that are coming out with retail or brand, what we're mostly seeing is kind of friends and family, kind of an amalgamation of like pseudo accredited investors that are being brought in and being able to kind of prop up these companies so they can have proof of concept and be in market and start getting top line revenue generation, and then are going to, you know, all these other additional groups to see if they can actually build out from there. Pretty commonplace now.
Yeah, and you know, that dovetails well into something in news recently about unionization. Obviously, we had this GTI strike at three of their dispensaries. There's been kind of, I guess, some differences in information, but essentially it was, I think they were getting paid $16.50 an hour. The Teamster union there also represented workers at Ascend, which were getting paid $19.50 an hour. Strike lasted 13 days, kind of started, I think, the day before or during 420, which made a huge impact. So on the larger topic, can you guys talk more about how many of these cannabis companies are unionizing? It's kind of like this industry, or not an industry, but it's kind of a thing that, like, I think it's more tied to like blue collar worker. It's kind of been forgotten about, but in cannabis, it's come back pretty strong in a lot of states, a lot of cities, a lot of employees of cannabis companies are unionizing. So can you kind of talk more about that?
Sure, I'll step in, yeah. So, you know, remember, unions are brought in as a last resort, typically when the employees have no other option, but we're not adverse to unions at all. However, it's really comes down to, I believe, communication with the senior leaders and the organization and the employees not feeling like they're heard. So I feel like that's what's causing a lot of the unions to really, I wouldn't say target, but really they're heeding the call from the employees there who feel like they're mistreated. And without representation, whether it's from the leader or from a union, you know, the employee really has no voice. And that's really what this is about. The employees in cannabis that I've come across are really more about the experience of cannabis, less than the job. So it's really, it's a lifestyle. So I feel like, if you're trying to run it like a traditional business, I think it's going to create challenges for the leadership team because they're not listening to their employees and they're not trying to understand the marketplace by which they service. So we always say, you know, think nationally, but act locally. So, you know, to try to understand if you want to go multi-state, that's great, but make sure your considerations at the local level are also there as well. So I'll just, Mike, jump in here if you want.
Well, let's like break through the fourth wall for a second. Ultimately, when we talk about companies, we talk about, you know, human capital. We use a lot of these platitudes. Ultimately, what you're talking about are people like us. We have families. You know, Day, you just had your daughter, you know, your second. Congratulations, by the way. You have a young mouth to feed. You know, these are mothers and fathers, sons and daughters who are seeing these jobs as career opportunities. And so if a company is not present and there to actually talk about career pathing, mentorship, training and development on a recurring basis, but also incentive planning, right? How are you being paid? How are we going to, when you have success in this role, how are we going to be able to enable you to not only be more successful so you can propel the business and by virtue of that, your lifestyle and your family, but how can we keep inundating you with expertise? And so the gap that I have been seeing in the conversations I've been having, and by the way, it's not that unionization is, again, it's not a negative thing. It is a circumstance derived when people feel like they're not having a better way with their company. And so for us, it's a question of not when or if you're going to have that conversation, but when. Most of these cannabis companies have to sign LPAs, labor peace agreements. And usually when you get into a conversation about collective bargaining agreement, what you're really talking about are grievances. You're talking about a way to distill grievances that people have on the front line that are not being reconciled, that are not being adhered or listened to. So again, it's not a negative thing necessarily to have a unionization conversation. The better way, and what we, Jason and I, get to do all the time through comp analysis, through conversation and conducting training and development, is to start enabling people at the frontline level and from an executive realm to make sure that a company feels and knows that it can propel its workforce. That way, when it comes to a conversation that you're inevitably going to have with the union, they feel seen, heard, cared for, and more importantly, comfortable in the fact that the company has best interests in mind, then you don't need a third party to derive value.
Yeah, and I'll jump in here, just one last point. You know, if you do an engagement survey, pick an industry. You know, I've done them in multiple industries outside of cannabis, but I've also done them in cannabis, and the same top three challenges come up no matter what: compensation, leadership communication, followed by career development of the individual. So that's the engagement index. There's another way also in those real good engagement surveys that do what's called the enablement index, which also means, do I have the tools to be successful in my job? So that sometimes gets ignored. So, you know, the top three are those three I just mentioned. So in my opinion, when we walk in, we always ask them, how's your comp? How's your leadership communication doing? Do you have career development programs? And that's a trigger for us to know that there could be a gap in an organization and something that we would like to address with them, or at least talk a little bit more about. But it's super important if you think about disengaged employees. And remember, for every disengaged employees, it takes three engaged employees to offset that. And that's from Gallup. And if it's a manager, it takes 10 engaged employees. So one manager disengaged takes 10 positive engaged employees to offset that.
And what do you guys recommend to some of these employers? Like, should they get ahead of it? When should they plan for it? You know, another one that comes to mind is Sweetflower sort of announced their agreement with, I believe, 6 stores in LA County with their union, UFCW Local 770. So how do you guys sort of strategize with employers and unions?
The way that I think about it is, well, strategy is like one part of it. Strategy can be episodic. It really is annual. What you're really talking about is strategy is just one part. It's almost like amateurs just do strategy, pros do strategy, and then logistics. When we speak to an executive team about doing compensation analysis and incentive programming, what you're really talking about is the lifeblood of the way in which you can perpetuate, you know, your SOPs, sure, but also how you're going to retain your talent. Again, attrition in cannabis is really high, really, really high. We always ask in these conversations, we kind of go into scientist mode where, you know, we have ideas, but they're not ideologies because those can calcify. We don't start with answer solutions. We lead with questions. It can't be a shallow analysis when it comes to your people, right? So we ask pointed questions or provide pointed scenarios, right? Pretend you're your competition. Got it? Okay, great. How do you kill your company? Inevitably, it is always the same answer, which is we lose people on a recurring basis. And as you know, in this climate, not just because of the macroeconomic situation we're in, but in cannabis specifically, you cannot have an iota of waste as is. So it's both a business prerogative and it's a cultural prerogative. It's an imperative, actually. And the conversation is always wide ranging. We start talking about personnel. Inevitably, it moves into the larger scope and scale of spans of control, conversations at the larger and at the micro level. Unions that we've spoken to, they have an idea about what would be best for cannabis workers. But keep in mind, you know, there's no global consensus on how to do a lot of this kinds of, you know, this type of work. There's no global consensus on how to grow weed. So for me, sometimes in conversations with unions, they might have kind of an uncalibrated viewpoint about what the type of work is and what's best suited for them. They're really talking about pay scale. For us, it's not just pay scale. It's everything behind that comes with it that propels people to want to live and breathe inside that company and that culture.
So something you mentioned, sort of pay scale, pay discrepancy, you know, I know there's not really a way today to say, hey, you're X worker in Y state, this is how much you should get paid, this is the range. How are you guys advising and dealing with that when there's a new state and sort of figuring out how much to pay?
Mike and I are heavily into the data because the data is the great way to, I mean, these are subjective decisions that take an emotional response with people, pay, incentives. So the best way to approach that is an objective approach, meaning we pull a lot of data from different sources, as well as we have differentials between states. So we understand cost of living allowances and we can even get as granular as counties. But what we say when we build a program, remember, incentives are to drive a certain behavior. So if you want to drive a behavior with somebody, that's why you give them a bonus in some cases. If you hit these targets, you get this, you know, carrot at the end. But it isn't always cash. So for the most part, what Mike and I are also doing is not just consulting on the pay side, but also the benefit side. Are you offering benefit programs, not just the traditional health met dental vision? I mean, it's something like today with you know, everyone online getting their identity stolen. Do you offer identity theft protection? There's a lot of great programs out there that are ancillary and don't cost a business a dime. So it's really the offerings and the incentive plans that wrap that make a culture is I like working here because. And usually an employee doesn't start with my base pay is X. What they start with is, oh, it's a welcoming culture where, you know, every Friday we have you know, we have a barbecue or something like that. It's really about collaboration. That's where we find a lot of the cultures are stronger, is when there's more of a connection with the individual on the experience rather than just the pay. But on the flip side, we also have the objective side of the pay as well. And in cannabis, because of all the hires and the years that Flower Hire has been in business, we have real data. You know, if you most traditional folks outside will take industry data and discount it and then provide it to a cannabis person. Well, that doesn't work. You know, it can give you a range, but it's mostly sometimes off by quite a bit, whether it's too low or too high. And then you have to deal with, you know, let's say someone goes from state to state. Well, you've already got two different ranges. So what we try to do is take that differential and apply it by the state. But we also have the umbrella approach where we have kind of the overarching industry standards for his base, you know, bonus, incentive, and even benefits. We also consult on that. And then when you get locally, then there could be some small adjustments, but that's not that hard. But that means you're paying attention. That's when the employees feel like, oh, you understand what it's like, you know, living in LA. Versus, you know, where I'm at in Detroit. And that's the difference. Again, it goes back to I'm being heard. I feel like you understand me, et cetera.
Yeah, I think the thing that's really interesting about our work over the last several years is, you know, the data points that we have, it's not enough to just have a compensation tool and provide overview. It's about being an active tool, right? It's predicated off live data, live market movements, and a history to borrow and learn from to inform the future. We have right now a number of different states that have been a showcase about the way you can derive value for people from the hourly, exempt, non-exempt status. You know, when we do recruitment, we talk to a litany of people that inhabit these roles, not just, you know, a role, right? That's one thing. You can provide a number in terms of what that person should be compensated for. We have context, situational analysis about not just a cultivation manager, you know, creating good outcomes for a company, size and scope of asset operation, number of lights, you know, yields. We get very granular in the information because, again, it's not freely out there. It's quite the opposite. Oh, it almost feels kind of like guild speak when you start getting to some of these hyper esoteric roles. So when we do a director of cultivation search, as an example, and we have a full cultivation practice dedicated to this, we have instances of single state, multi-state operators and brands that have their own cultivation size and scope. You know, the person that oversees that particular asset, that particular size and scope of team, that's situational analysis. So it changes in many instances, you know, the rubric in terms of how you get to value their competency and their skill. And we have that on a recurring basis all the time. Every conversation we have, we're verifying and validating what someone at the retail or, you know, processing extraction, what their expectation might be. We also have people outside scope of cannabis that have their own pre-existing, you know, pay scale. How does that conform, contort, or change when they come into cannabis? Sometimes it diverts and it's not worth the conversation. Or sometimes you have instances where you have a new marketplace where you're hiring for not skill, but potential. Sometimes you have to be honest about the fact that people that have a pre-existing knowledge or skill basis for something in cannabis is going to be very light. The next best thing is you can do an approximation. But we have tens of thousands of data points to qualify from where we don't just say, this is what you pay the person. This is what you pay the person predicated off their pre-existing experience, what they've overseen, people they've directed and controlled. And that's very powerful and very enlightening. Most tools out there, like a salary.com, they just discount it down without actually giving contextual analysis of the ability.
And it's old data, right? That's static data taken from a year prior, where ours is dynamic data, which is real time. It's a big difference.
So what percentage of searches are executives versus non-executive searches for you guys?
Executive search is minimal because there's only so many people actually that have at that echelon. The vast majority of roles that we, you know, have been focusing on really exist in kind of middle management. And when I say, you know, roles, you know, make side, cultivation, site operations, manufacturing, extraction, quality, wholesale, marketing, retail, D2C delivery, product, you know, accounting, finance. The lifeblood of most of the searches live and breathe in that middle realm.
Yeah, that makes sense. And reason why I was asking that question is you kind of have seen this migration of people, right? Because there wasn't a legal cannabis industry for too long. So people are coming from regulated industries, coming from outbev. We've seen people flow in and out. So, you know, where does that sit today in terms of, are people still very excited to enter the cannabis industry? Because I do see people leaving as well for, you know, kind of slower moving industry than they might have expected. And then going back to kind of pay and pay scale and ranges, are they being incentivized, especially at the executive search level, similarly from a cash comp, or why are they choosing today, right, to join this industry?
I think there's a loaded answer, and not everyone will freely share in this. Some people see it as a get rich quick schema, which anyone listening out there that believes this is that, it's not, quite the opposite. What's typical is it's a few things. Usually it's a personal reason where someone in their life, usually a family member, oftentimes a parent, found alleviation from pain or some kind of ailment, right? So it's a visceral thing. A lot of people also have been using cannabis, you know, on the low or out loud for quite some time. So they have a very intimate relationship with the plant itself. I would say, though, the line that runs through most of the conversations with people is there's a part of them that feels like what they're doing is very conventional, and they have an inspiration, or they have unconventional thinking. And what is entrepreneurism if not unconventional, right? You're going to basically take a leap of faith on something that's relatively unknown, or you're going to build something that wasn't there. That's usually the lifeblood of most people that get excited about cannabis, because they know, even though it's early, they know the promise is not a hollow one. They know that they can get in and actually get educated and get experience. And that experience in cannabis as an executive or any role really is really almost, if not impossible, to mimic outside the confines of the space. So when people look at this space and are trying to understand where their place is in it, there's an excitement on some level because it hits home in so many ways. But I also think they know it's because the promise that is, again, constantly something that we're always striving for, and eventually that's going to be enunciated very loud, it'll prove out. It's just, do they have the patience and the durability and the mindset to get to that point? That's the point when you start having brain drain. And that's probably, I would say, one of the biggest issues in cannabis is expertise that have been here, that have qualified, great methodology, great mantras, great leadership, that can't live inside this contentious realm. They leave. It's almost impossible to take that or find someone that can repeat the same experience. It's almost impossible.
And that's exactly, I'm one of those people. I came from over a $1 billion, global chief people officer role. And I stepped into cannabis, not to get rich scheme, but a different reason too. One, Mike mentioned, I had a family member who had cancer, passed away, but it was a really good, I guess pain reliever. And being an HR guy, unfortunately, I out in industry, I really wasn't a user. I got into the industry not just because of that, but I also got in because people like me and other executives, when you work for a larger company, there's not much you can change. Stuff's legacy, less creativity. So for me, and I feel like others as well, it's a spot where we can create. And we can bring, we don't bring the sins of the past into this industry. So we can mold this industry with really good things that we know work, rather than, the traditional way of doing business, which doesn't have to be. We should not have to repeat history. Why not? We should be, coming here to create and to, make this a better industry. So I feel a lot of executives like myself, and I stayed in it. I could have left. I could have went back, right? It's not about the money. It's about the creativity. And the money will be there. But, it's an ability to say, well, I was part of that, and I had an influence in that, and I feel really good about that.
I would also just add to that, that when people get into cannabis, whether it's entry or middle management, there's a tremendous amount of mobility. And the culture itself is very pronounced. We know how hard it is to actually live and breathe as an operator in this space. And we get to work with people who understand that stress. There's kind of a camaraderie in that. And it's very out in front, outspoken when people meet one another in the cannabis space, because just how challenging the environment actually is. But the mobility piece, you can get into the cannabis space free and clear as an entry-level person or even a mid-tier, get an education, and then also your career trajectory can precipitously and dramatically rise in terms of role, responsibility, and managerial perspective. And I think that's very alluring for a lot of people in America that want to find something that actually not only speaks to them on a personal level, but on a cultural as well as a career trajectory and development path can really, really help them get to a place where their earning power goes up, the responsibilities go up, and also by virtue of confidence in themselves. So there's a tremendous amount of mobility. The asterisk is always, is the company you're working for one that is going to hold that in high esteem? Are they going to propel you?
Yeah. So on that point, the education point, that is, what do you think is working well to educate some of these entry levels mid-level folks? Is it something like a green flower? Is it something that certain companies are doing correctly? Like, what sort of education and training in the industry is working, in your opinion?
I mean, it's varied. There are institutions, University of Maryland has its own programming. You know, more and more junior colleges and colleges are actually creating programming around cannabis and a dialogue. Green, you know, Max Simon at Greenflower has done a very good job of actually inundating participants outside the marketplace with an education and arc of learning that is, again, it's almost like how to put this. In a way, when I look at companies like Greenflower, what they're really doing is taking best practices and insights on a recurring basis and refining it. I'm always a little leery about new groups that are entering the space in the educational piece, because when they do a certification program, that doesn't mean anything in terms of job placement, right? So there's lots of places that are educating. The next conversation I have after that is, well, the application of that. If I learn to be a bud tender or a middle management or retail manager, but in a market that has no cannabis to speak of, or it's, you know, or it's primarily medical, where's the application for that knowledge basis? I have found in my experience, a lot of universities have student groups. You know, USC Marshall has the Trojan Cannabis Network. It's a self-avowed, self-selected group that are hosting seminars, webinars, conversations. I would say that the ad hoc one that I'm really impressed by is the mentorship. A lot of companies or individuals inside companies are actually creating a center of gravity for people that have expertise from all different marketplaces to talk about whatever their primary focus might be, whether it's cultivation, extraction, retail. So I think it's multi-pronged. It's not just about education where you get, you know, something to put up on LinkedIn. The education that we hear about and read about are institutions like Flower or for Greenflower. The thing I'm seeing a lot more though of is like student unions, student groups, informal, trying to be formal, trying to get accreditation. And then I also see the mentorship program in cannabis be very, very high. Like, you know, veterans in cannabis are very well connected and are very, very outspoken in terms of sharing best practices, very much so.
Yeah, and good cannabis companies also educate, you know, where their stores are. So I think it's not just internal employees being educated, but also education of the community by which, you know, you're servicing with your, you know, your cannabis store. I think it's important that companies really consider that, because I think those that do that actually have a more well-rounded, I guess, spot in the community, but they, you know, the community learns as well, right? So they know, you know, what works for them, because it is a scary thing for some people because it still has a negative connotation. You know, it's going to take a while for some of the traditionalists to come around, but they're coming around. And I think, to Mike's point, I think veterans are, in my opinion, an underserved group still that I think has a lot of capabilities for this industry to help. So I'm really excited to see that pick up. And Mike and I, you know, we always think about that group and how can we, you know, continue to help support them.
Yeah, and going back to Greenflower, like a program that they have is Ganjie. Like, does that impact hiring for you guys, or is it like a nice to have? You know, and I assume if all else equal and someone has gone through that program, it may give them a leg up on a similar resume.
It's not like a specific, it's not a silver bullet by any stretch of the imagination. It does help to have context in terms of the considerations and the inputs and having a knowledge basis. It's really not like a prereq by any stretch of the imagination. Most people, keep in mind, that are hiring for these roles, they're hiring out of necessity or potential or skill. Sometimes there might be, you know, a conversation about someone having some semblance of cannabis experience, but by and large, that's pretty hard to find. You know, talented pools of people, especially by virtue of NIMBY laws, you're not going to have someone that has any conceptual knowledge basis of cannabis as is. So what we do as much as possible is always ask, like, what do you know about cannabis? Or what do you know? Or have you facilitated a dialogue with people? If they don't have any kind of programming, we always say, we're happy to make introductions for you so you can get some kind of, you know, informal conversation. That way you have a semblance of idea about where to work from or what kinds of considerations there are. But it's not a prereq by any stretch of the imagination, no.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think the industry is like too nascent to have something like that, you know, be instrumental in a hiring decision. I mean, even when I was in beer before cannabis, having a Cicerone program, which is the sommelier equivalent, not a lot of people were getting those certifications, so it didn't matter as much.
Right.
So let's talk about the executive level, right? And also more recent news, Ascend announced their new CEO, which they used one of the more traditional executive search firm to run that process, was the former president of Bye Bye Baby. From your experiences in terms of candidates you place at kind of the C-level, what's sort of a good background to have that you've seen be successful once they've entered the cannabis industry for, let's say, the first time?
Having been one, to me, it's really, in my opinion, immersing yourself in the business. I had no clue what the grow did. I my brother was a grower, but I myself hadn't, seen the scale that I saw and how this works. And the retail side, having worked retail, when I was younger in high school for many years, I understood that industry, but its uniqueness. But for an executive coming in, to me, is immersing yourself in job shadowing and understanding the business. I always have an approach: listen, learn, and lead. So listen to what people are telling you as it relates to how they do things. Learn why they do it a certain way, and then start to interject and lead. And even when you lead, you do it in the form of questions, because have you considered? Have you thought of? I've been more successful by doing it that approach in cannabis, because if you come in with a commanding style, well, this is how I know how it should be done, it's not well received. I've seen people come in as executives and burn out real quick. So it's really important on the recruitment side. I know Flower Hired spends a lot of time really weeding through. I think folks, there's kind of a competency there, of a learning competency, as well as less commanding of a competency for an executive. Those are the ones that succeed. So I think if you're an executive trying to get in, if it's a money grab, it's not the place. It can be eventually, but it's really an opportunity for an individual to learn a different industry, as well as be a part of its creation and structuring of the formation of that, and just being open to learning. Again, that's what's going to make an executive most successful.
Yeah, I always kind of flipped it when I speak to executives that are curious about the space or feel like their time at maybe a parallel industry might be better served in a place like the cannabis space. I always work backwards and actually ask them questions just about the enunciation of the fact that cannabis is a social want, it's a social norm, but you still have to realize that there's a vast array of Americans somewhere that think that this whole enterprise is a threat to social norms and institutions. So I kind of try to break the fourth wall and peel back and take off the sheen of the space. And I start with, well, do you actually know what this is? What I often try to do in conversation, and definitely everyone on our team does this as well, is try to understand the fact that you can't be unidimensional, right? You have to be multifaceted, you have to be multi-purpose, multi-pronged. You also have to be very willing and candid about the fact that you, to Jason's point, have to get kind of a re-education, not just on the expertise of the discipline that you have, but the application of that here. What does and does not work? You can't just superimpose best practices seemingly over cannabis and hope that it'll stick. You have to kind of enunciate what things could work or have worked for you, and have kind of an entrepreneurial bent of willing to experiment and find new and novel ways for application. So it's not so much what they have done or what they think they can do. Again, it's kind of a repurposing and re-educating their expertise and their mindsets to knowing that this is an entrepreneurial endeavor. Sometimes it's just not a fit. They will just say that I haven't been in that position a long time where I have to be a utility player. In cannabis, you really have to kind of have this juxtaposition, because it's the natural gravity of what we do, between working with people heads up on a recurring basis on a personal level. You don't have buffers and buffers of middle management sometimes. Sometimes you're front and center, front line, lifting 50 pounds on a Saturday to make ends meet. I think that dispels the notions of cannabis being simple or easy. And I think what it does is starts enunciating to a lot of executives that, sure, it might be relevant in your experience. Are you willing to not conform or contort, but change and reapproach the ways in which you've done work prior? Sometimes that sticks, sometimes it does not.
It's really about, making sure you can roll up your sleeves and actually want to roll up your sleeves, being humble.
Yeah, because I think that's what's lost on a lot of people, that even some of the larger companies in this industry are essentially like growth stage startups, right? I mean, look at the market cap of the five largest companies. They're a few billion other market leaders are, you know, in the hundreds of billions. So very much so still a growth stage startup. So last question for you guys, and I know, you know, it's something that you guys pay attention to. You know, the industry pays billions in taxes. You know, lobbying is probably anywhere from $6 to $8 million a year. A lot of taxes paid, but from a lobbying standpoint, not a lot of clout. So, you know, Mike, I know this is like a topic you love to kind of discuss. How do you think the cannabis as an industry can do better on actually having, you know, some progress? You know, now we're up for safe banking for the 9th time, right? So like,
sure.
I just don't see that happening in other big, you know, $100 billion industries.
I mean, I think we have to be honest about the fact that we're on the economic peripheral, despite the fact that we're going to be, I mean, a bright shining star as we get closer to a point where we're no longer illegal, but just at this point, illegitimate. I think the best thing to do is be very honest about the fact that we should no longer want and be a bargaining chip. What we really want to be is at the seat at the table. And it's bizarre, you know, to, how do I put this? It's kind of odd to be in a space that you know is growing dramatically, that has so much economic empowerment, but at the same time is not actually being able to enact change on a recurring basis. It's kind of like a history upended, right? If this was a typical start to an industry that grew as fast as we do, the political realm would be kissing the ring immediately. That absence of power does not and should not sit with anyone, and providing so much economic impact yet being reduced to a bargaining chip at best shows that our political clout is not wide ranging or hasn't even arrived yet. I think what we need to do is mobilize, and the fact that we have a disparate amount of influence that just isn't consolidated to one place. It's not just about getting the financial durability on the Hill to make effective change. It's about bringing disparate groups together to, as a collective force, to actually enact change for ourselves. Again, going back to the idea of veterans group, I don't think people realize this, but in veterans, a lot of times what they get in terms of benefits by virtue of the service actually gets stripped, actually participating in this space. How could that sit with anybody? Or the fact that, you know, we mentioned unionizations a moment ago, you know, when it comes to the idea of creating a political disturbance, what we have to do is take, you know, labor force, unionized laborers in conjunction with veterans, as well as the fact that, you know, the DEI initiatives, and we have this massive hypocrisy in cannabis that we want to reconcile. We need to bring all of those talking points into focus as a unified front that we can move in tandem. Right now, it's hard to do that when you're so when it's so fragmented and so many people are disenchanted. You really have to kind of have a siren's call for everyone to rally around in order to make that effective change. Otherwise, we're just hoping and praying for the day when safe banking trundles its way through the House up to the Senate and somehow passes grade. What we have to do is get active, but again, in conjunction with one another, not just as a special interest on a one-off.
But like, who would take that on, right? So if I just look at like the 2022 data for amount spent on lobbying by cannabis firms, 5.8 million, you have names like Canopy, Cresco, Coalition for Cannabis Policy, Education and Regulation, National Cannabis Roundtable, U.S. Cannabis Council, Ghost Management Group, Kronos Group, right? So there's a lot of disparate groups. Like, who's going to take the baton and kind of run with this? I know it's a collective effort, but like, who's going to go and do it?
I think you have to make in my opinion, a singular mandate where you have all these disparate groups that actually find a uniform way to speak as one collective voice. Because right now, every time a market goes live, you have a million associations that crop up by virtue of that. All of them trying to, you know, create better communal impact and empowerment. What you really need to do, though, in my opinion, is have, I don't know, call it a summit where everyone has a collective force and they all want this change. But the fact that they each are kind of, again, in different areas, different marketplaces, different states, it's hard for that community to be singular. You have to run a line through all of that and equivocate it and act as a collective force. So I don't think it's just one group. I think it's all the groups that we have working in tandem with one another, all the associations, all the groups, even student bodies and unions. How we do that, I think we have to make a summit. We have to make a collective force. We have to make a proposition to the market to move as one. That's a big undertaking. I know that's like a pipe dream, and I see you smiling.
No, but I'm following you guys. I'm going to say, you just give yourself homework. So the first inaugural our summit, Mike is running. You're going to bring all these groups together. You're going to have these discussions. you know, we're going to drive more lobbying power for the industry.
Just as long as you wear your baby on the front side of your body and you just enunciate that to the world, because that's the point, right? If we speak as an industry, that's one thing. If we speak as a collective people from communities and states that want effective change, that's another. If we're talking about labor union and we're talking about veterans, that's another. If we talk about mothers and fathers, sons and daughters looking for a better way as a collective force, that's a conversation, a dialogue that anyone that has in the political realm, they'd have to heed that.
Yeah, no. So if you do it, I will definitely attend. I will bring both my daughters. One of them is born on 420. So she'll definitely be the one that'll be there.
Was Brooklyn born on 420?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, so I had a different kind of 420 than you guys the last few weeks.
That's congratulations. That's amazing.
Congrats.
Cool. I know you guys have to run, so we can end it here.
Wait, can I, before we go though, can I do one shout out for the team?
Yeah, go for it.
Just for everyone listening, I just want to give a special shout out to everyone on the Flower Hire crew and team.
All 25 employees.
Takesha Harvey, Berlina Harris, Dave Belsky, Samantha Schoenberger, Julia Swenson, Amy Rose Eisenbach, Aisha Alves, Ian Kilty, Sarah Rake, Kelsey Barton, Michael Sorella, Alan Good, Pasquale Iannino, Cam Holzer, Jason and myself, hey, Patrick Hartman, Anthony Sinella, Jen Belsky, David Belsky, Gabriel Harrington, Lauren Ryan, Brian Fitzgerald, Karen Meshkoff, Michelle Williams. Thank you, Dave.
Okay, so was that the entire employee roster?
That was the entire team.
They deserve it. The hardest working people in cannabis, I just mentioned.
They are.
Appreciate that, guys. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for having us.